Looking good, Billy Ray.
Feeling good, Lewis.
Looka here. Look who's back to the Rack Like Shack, making a comeback to record highs. Try to theorize, but don't be surprised to see assets across classes shooting through the skies. I'm talking mid-cap, small-caps, the NASDAQ and Diamondback. Home builders Caterpillar, Williams-Sonoma and Toyota. JP Morgan, KLA, they got Salesforce like Yoda. Help me, Obi-Wan, where's my dude Han Solo? They're buying up Bitcoin, holding like YOLO. NFTs are back in style, moon birds and bored apes. Popping bottles on the yacht, shrimp and lobster on their plate. Risk is back and that's a fact, traders printing mad stacks. Scraping tendies off the table, Fury rode like Mad Max. We know from recent history this fervor doesn't last, but if you're not running with the bulls, you get run over fast. Pick your lane, pick your style, this requires some finesse. That's why we're always fitted on the Investopedia Express. Welcome back and welcome aboard, and hold on tight because this train is going higher. That's right, Mr. Bradley, a little bit higher all over the place. The S&P 500 closed last week at another all-time high, the 15th of the year so far. The NASDAQ finally made a new all-time high, joining the High Flyers Club, and so did mid-cap stocks, Japan's Nikkei 225, and gold futures.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
You're right, Dorothy. We are not in Kansas anymore. We are in uncharted waters. And other sectors and asset classes are chasing 52-week or all-time highs as well, like small caps and Bitcoin. It's a melt-up across asset classes, so grab some chips and let's have a nachos party. February ended up being a lot warmer to the stock market than it has historically been, as the S&P 500 finished up with a gain of 5% for the month. That has only happened 11 times since 1928. Now, I don't want to be no Chicken Little this far away from Thanksgiving, but the last time the market gained 5% or more in February, which is one of the worst months of the year for the stock market, historically speaking, that was back in 2015. That March, the market fell nearly 2% and ended the year down 3%. It also happened back in 1931 when the S&P gained more than 11% in February. But then the bottom fell out completely, dropping 55% for the year, one of the worst crashes in history. But this is no 1931 or 2015 for that matter, and most of us are not making our investment decisions looking at a monthly historical average. If we did, we would have missed all the upside last month. Plus, this upward march for stocks has been pretty orderly. We've gone 86 trading days without even a 2% pullback for the S&P 500. No volatility, no panic selling, no pictures of traders at the New York Stock Exchange with their heads in their hands. Nothing but eerie optimism on the part of investors, and it's spreading across the market, which leads us directly into our big three for the week. Number one, if you zoom way out and look at the path to record highs for the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, even the Dow Industrials, which recently hit all-time highs as well, you'll notice that the major U.S. equity markets have actually been performing on trend or even a little bit better for the past 4 years. We're coming right up on the four-year anniversary mark of the beginning of the pandemic, and we've experienced two bear markets in that time period. One right at the onset of the pandemic and the lockdowns that brought the S&P down 35% for a few weeks, and then the bear market of 2022 following the year of irrational exuberance. The market fell 24% that year. Since March 1st of 2020, the S&P 500 is up 66%, or an average of 16.5% per year. The NASDAQ is up 81% in that period, or 20% plus per year, and the Dow is up 46%, or a little better than 10% a year. For investors in the modern era, those are pretty good returns commensurate with the risk we take to invest in stocks. And given that bonds have basically been in a bear market for the entire time, the alternative, stocks in this case, has been the place to be. Which leads us to number two. The bullishness in the stock market is getting contagious. Barclays was the latest bank to raise its forecast for the S&P 500 for the year to 5,300 from 4,800. Well, since the market already blew past 4,800 a few weeks ago, the British Investment Bank is a little late to the rodeo. Already seated at the bull ring with elevated forecasts is Goldman Sachs, CFRA, UBS, and the Royal Bank of Canada. The common denominator behind all this optimism is the impact these banks think AI will have on productivity and profit margins across industries, and optimism around the new slew of weight loss drugs coming to the market. And it's not just banks that are bullish. Individual investors are as bullish as they've been in 12 months, according to our recent survey and the AAII survey. Not ragingly bullish, but generally optimistic about higher returns in the next 6 to 12 months. And financial advisors are as bullish as they've ever been, according to B of A research. Only 4% of advisors surveyed are expecting a recession this year, and 77% expect the bull market to continue beyond 2024. On a scale of 1 to 10, advisors rank their bullishness over the next 12 months at 7.5. That's the highest level in the history of the survey. Now, keep in mind that extreme levels of optimism have been pretty reliable contrarian indicators. Investors always swing too far on the emotional pendulum in both directions. That's just the way we are. And number three, you know what other chart just keeps going up to the right? The national debt, of course, and this country is in hyperspending mode. Some real Millennium Falcon type hyperspending. That's right, Chewy. The U.S. national debt has been rising by $1 trillion every 100 days or so. We went from $32 trillion to $33 trillion in just 92 days, $33 to $34 trillion in 106 days, and we're going to get from $34 trillion to $35 trillion in just 95 days. That's the cost of doing business in this country, which now includes financing for the wars in the Middle East and Ukraine and for the spending increases passed by the Biden administration over the past 3 years. That spending may have steadied the economy coming out of the pandemic and made it stronger today than it might have otherwise been, but the U.S. budget deficit over the past 4 years has been 9.3% of GDP. It's never been higher, and it's only going higher. So if you're wondering why gold and Bitcoin prices are hitting or nearing all-time highs, look no further than the so-called debt debasement trade. Investors buy gold when they think the economy is on an unsustainable and unhealthy path, and now you can say the same thing for Bitcoin. Bitcoin holders care nothing about the U.S. debt and deficit. The higher the debt, the more reason to own a digital asset that has nothing to do with it. Let's get set up for the week ahead and a brand new month. March has historically been the fifth best month of the year for the stock market and the fourth best over the past 20 years if you're investing on the lunar calendar. And after a strong February, when the market rises 5% or more, the S&P 500 has been higher 5 out of 6 times since 1950, just not 2015, as we talked about earlier. A better-than-expected earnings season has been one of the catalysts for record highs for the market, and this week we're going to get results from Costco, Target, Ross Stores, CrowdStrike, and Broadcom, among others. With corporate earnings, though, mostly behind us, the spotlight shifts back to the U.S. economy and the labor market. The February jobs report will be released on Friday, and economists are expecting around 190,000 job gains for the month, with the unemployment rate holding around 3.7%. If the numbers come in around that range, that will demonstrate a normalizing of the labor market after that red-hot January jobs report. We're going to keep a close eye on wage gains because the Fed keeps a close eye on wage gains, and they're expected to slow from that 0.6% jump they had back in January. Fed Chair Powell will be on Capitol Hill this week, delivering testimony to the House and Senate this Wednesday and Thursday. He's going to stick to the script, repeating that the central bank is data dependent, and the data is not telling it to cut interest rates anytime soon. Right now, traders are betting the Fed will make its first rate cut in June or maybe as late as the July meeting. The next FOMC meeting is March 12th. President Biden will address the nation this week in the State of the Union address on Thursday, where he's going to reportedly propose raising taxes for corporations and high earners and press for lower prescription drug prices and health insurance rates. Biden's speech is also expected to highlight the economic progress made under his administration, including the passage of the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act. Alabama Senator Katie Britt will deliver the Republican response. The State of the Union address will come after voters in 16 states head to the polls earlier this week for the Super Tuesday primary election, which helps set the stage for the 2024 presidential, congressional, and gubernatorial races. Buckle up. LL Cool J likes to say, don't call it a comeback, but I don't know what else to call it because Bitcoin has come all the way back near its 2021 highs, touching $63,000 per Bitcoin last week. There may be some good reasons for this. Interest rates are on their way lower, not anytime soon, but maybe by mid-year we'll start to see some rate cuts, and risky assets like crypto love low interest rates. Then there's the Bitcoin halving coming up this spring. That basically means that it's going to take twice as long to mine one Bitcoin, which means tighter supply, which is usually good for a price bump. And those spot Bitcoin ETFs we've been talking about, those have been on the market now for the past couple of months, and they are starting to take in real assets. Bitwise has been right in the middle of this melee. Its spot Bitcoin ETF, the Bitcoin Bitwise ETF, ticker BITB, has been one of those new exchange-traded funds that has been taking in some of that money flow. And Matt Hogan, the chief investment officer for Bitwise, has had a ringside seat to all of this, and he's our guest this week on The Express. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks for having me. I love the LL Cool J intro. That's pretty great. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Well, LL sometimes just puts it perfectly, and he did this time again. I've seen that the Bitwise Bitcoin ETF has already crossed the $1 billion mark in assets under management. That was pretty fast. Were you surprised by the uptake?
Absolutely. These have been the fastest growing ETFs of all time. They've exceeded my expectations, and I spent 15 years in the ETF industry before coming to Bitwise in 2018. Yeah, BITB is at about $1.5 billion today. We continue to get inflows every day. We've had inflows every single day since it launched, except for one when we were flat. And I actually expect that to continue. In fact, I think there may be a secondary acceleration in flows as we get into April or May or June that I'm looking forward to. So really pleased with the reception. And I think we're still in the early stages of it.
Yeah, well, I've heard you say that you think there's more coming because the institutions really haven't gotten involved here. This has been a lot of flows from retail investors, from hedge funds, and financial advisors. How can you tell?
Well, for one thing, we know that it's not approved at many institutional levels, right? So it's not approved yet at the wirehouses. People think ETFs are launched and the spigot is turned wide open. Actually, ETFs are launched and it's turned open a little bit. Retail can buy it, hedge funds, independent financial advisors, and then wirehouses can buy it. And then institutional consultants do their due diligence on it. I was at one of the largest institutional consultants in the world earlier this week talking about our Bitcoin ETF. So it'll take a few months, but we're starting to see approvals at places like Morgan and Wells and UBS and others. And that's when the spigot opens fully wide. And I think we could see continued inflows. But already, these are the fastest growing ETFs of all time.
How do you think institutions like those on Wall Street or Canary Wharf or around the world in Hong Kong are going to treat these spot Bitcoin ETFs? And how will retail investors like us feel it? Are we going to feel it in price? Are we going to feel it in volatility? Are we going to feel it in cost? How are we going to feel that, you know, when the big guys get in the room, so to speak?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you've already felt it in cost, right? Before these ETFs launched, the largest fund in the US charged 2%. Now BITB charges 20 basis points. So the arrival of these institutional products that retail can already access has dropped the fees of accessing Bitcoin literally by 90%. That's pretty exciting. You're going to see it in price and in, I believe, a reduction in Bitcoin's volatility. So let me take those two. Why will you see it in price? Bitcoin's price is set by supply and demand. This is a major new source of demand, right? These institutions control, you know, depending on who you ask, up to $100 trillion of assets. They couldn't buy Bitcoin before this ETF. Now they can. So major new demand. The second thing I think you'll see a somewhat of a diminution of Bitcoin's volatility. And the reason for that is you're getting different types of investors into the asset. Institutions are long-term buy and hold investors. They tend to rebalance. They sell if it goes up. They buy if it goes down. I think that activity will sort of balance out some of the volatility we've historically seen in Bitcoin. Make no mistake, I still expect it to be very volatile. I still expect it to be very volatile. But I do think you're going to see slightly less volatility. I think you're going to see higher prices. And you're already seeing much, much lower fees.
I've heard you also say that these ETFs could be on pace to take in up to $55 billion in assets under management over the next 5 years or so. That's a big number for a new product, but still kind of relatively small when you think about the universe of bonds and stocks. Why that number? Take us through the math of how you kind of get there.
Yeah, I think I may be revising that up, but here's what I did to get at that number. I looked at the ETFs, the Bitcoin ETFs that were launched in other markets like Canada, Brazil, and Europe. And they were all trending to be about 1% of the ETF market in those jurisdictions. If you look in the US market, ETFs are a $7 trillion market. That would lead you to believe that Bitcoin ETFs would trend toward about $70 billion. But some of that was already present in GBTC, which was an OTCQX traded trust that converted to an ETF. So after you adjust—
That's the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust you're talking
about. That's the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. After you adjusted for that, I got about $55 billion. That would be about 1% of the US ETF market. But based on these flows, I think it could be two or three or even four times that. It's important to note, before these ETFs launched, the fastest growing ETF of all time was the QQQs, the NASDAQ 100 product. It got to $5 billion by its first year. These ETFs have pulled in $7.5 billion plus in net assets in their first 2 months. So I think that $55 billion may be a bit conservative. It may be higher than that.
So there's the institutions that may be coming into this. And then there's the financial advisors that are working with clients like me to give us exposure through this vehicle. Why is this a better vehicle potentially for retail investors, those working with advisors, or even self-guided investors than buying Bitcoin outright, putting it in a cold wallet, or owning it on one of the exchanges? Or what's the benefit?
Yeah. You know, look, I think it's great for people who want to own Bitcoin themselves to download it into a hard wallet and to experience sort of native Bitcoin. But compared to these other options, like buying it on exchange, it's cheaper. The taxes are easier. You don't have to report your own tax basis. You just get a letter at the end of the year from KPMG. The custody is more secure. It's always in cold storage. It's not on a hot wallet. And then most importantly, it fits in your brokerage account. Look, most investors invest their money through their brokerage account, through one window or a financial advisor who controls that. They don't have 10 different apps. So why would you access Bitcoin through an app and your stocks through your brokerage account? Just put them in the same place where they can be managed together. And as a bonus, it's cheaper, it's more liquid, it's more secure, the taxes are easier, and you have the protections of federal securities laws. It's really just a win-win compared to the other formats that are out there.
Okay, so you have a lot of experience in the ETF industry. You were the CEO of ETF.com for a while. Take us through the mechanisms of how these spot Bitcoin ETFs work. We've done some work on this podcast before, but because this is sort of, they're here now and you can buy them, how are they assembled at places like Bitwise? How does the creation redemption process work, so to speak, which is the mechanism that you actually run ETFs with?
That's exactly right. So when people buy these ETFs, at the end of the day, authorized participants can create more shares to fulfill that demand. What they do is they send us cash. So like on the first day of BITB, we got $230 million of cash. We then go out into the market and source Bitcoin. The way we do it is we put up to seven different institutional counterparties at competition bidding for the right to sell us that Bitcoin. So we'll call Jane Street and ask for a quote, and we'll call another market maker and ask for a quote. And then we take the best available quote. I'll tell you something incredible. We bought, you know, north of $1 billion of Bitcoin. The average execution has been between 1 and 4 basis points above the price, the NAV of the fund, which is just an incredible level of execution. Once we buy it, those institutional counterparties deposit it with our custodian. So it's always in cold storage. And then we pay them the cash. And the Bitcoin ETFs hold, you know, a proportional level of Bitcoin to the cash that comes in. So we now hold, you know, north of 20,000 Bitcoin. One fun thing about our fund is you can see that for yourself. We're the only ETF that to date has published its Bitcoin address. You can enter our address into a blockchain explorer and see exactly how many Bitcoin we own at any minute of the day, which is pretty fun.
Folks, we will link to these resources in the show notes because that is unusual and fascinating. And for an asset, a new asset class, relatively new, like Bitcoin, certainly these ETFs, that should be fascinating to watch. You've also talked about the fact that, hey, a lot of players came forward with spot Bitcoin ETFs out of the gate. They won't all last, which is just kind of the natural course for how markets work, especially with new asset classes. What's the consolidation going to look like? And who's going to determine, or how is it going to be determined who survives and thrives in this environment?
Yeah, I would say there are at least 5 ETFs that have gotten escape velocity, by which they mean they're over $1 billion of assets and they're growing quickly and trading, you know, $100 million or more every day. We're fortunate that BITB is one of them. But they're great ETFs from firms like iShares, Fidelity, and others. I think generally speaking, people want a few choices. Some people want to go with the biggest brands, firms like BlackRock. Some people want to go with a crypto specialist, firms like Bitwise. Some people want to go with the lowest cost provider, and we're happy to be the lowest cost amongst those large ETFs. I think this market is big enough for there to be 5, 6, 7, 8 successful ETFs. Will they all survive? Probably not. But that's the way the ETF market works, right? People take shots on goal, and then the ones that survive, survive. And this is a very healthy market. Again, the fastest growing ETF market of all time.
So if I'm considering buying one of these, either on my own or through my financial advisor, what are the most important questions I need to ask before I actually do it?
Yeah, absolutely. You should look at the fee because there are big differences. There's one ETF that charges 1.5%. And we charge 20 basis points. Even amongst the most successful, you know, our fund is 20% cheaper than BlackRock or Fidelity. So fees are important. How does it trade? Is it trading close to its net asset value? And then is it backed by someone who has expertise in crypto? So they know how to go out and source that Bitcoin liquidity, which allows the fund to perform as you hope it to be. Those are the three factors I would look at. And there are differences between these ETFs.
Liquidity is everything when it comes to ETFs because, you know, you need one that has kind of robust flows coming into it. You want people to be excited about it. And when it goes below a certain point there's almost nothing that can save it. All right, what's next on the horizon? Are we going to see a spot Ether ETF or a spot Cardano ETFs? Are ETFs good wrappers for all of these tokens, or is there something about Bitcoin because of its prevalence and because it's the best known and most widely held of these that makes it special?
Yeah, I think we will eventually see a spot Ethereum ETF. There are regulated Ethereum futures. There are Ethereum futures ETFs. I see no real reason why we won't get a spot Ethereum ETF in the future. I think it could take a while. There's a possible approval date in May. I'm not sure that we'll get one in May, but will we get one within the next 12 months? I think that's likely. These ETFs work. They lower costs. They make it safer for investors. It's going to take a while to get beyond Bitcoin and Ethereum. And the reason for that is even though these are spot ETFs, they rely on the existence of regulated futures markets to help surveil the market and make sure there's no market manipulation. And right now, there's only regulated Bitcoin and Ethereum futures. So Bitcoin and Ethereum, the good news is that's 70% of the market. So you're getting the majority of the market. I think we'll be there within a year and we'll get more assets down the road. Eventually, we'll have ETFs on a wide variety of crypto assets, but that could take a few years.
So the regulatory front is always an issue when it comes to cryptocurrency or really any asset class. But we know Gary Gensler at the SEC and his team have been eyeballing this really closely. It took them a long time to approve the spot Bitcoin ETFs. You're talking about potential approval for Ethereum ETF down the road. What else needs to happen on the regulatory front? What other obstacles or hurdles are out there for a provider like you to make this more mainstream and deliver even bigger results?
Yeah, look, in the long run, what we need are new rules and regulations that allow crypto to fit within the federal securities laws. Right now, there's an element of round peg in a square hole. These rules were written in 1940 and 1933. They're approaching 100 years old. We shouldn't feel bad or be surprised that they're not a perfect fit for digital assets. No one was thinking about that in 1940. So eventually, we're going to need new rules and regulations. But I would say we're making a lot of progress. If you go back 5, 7, 10 years ago, there were no regulated custodians. Institutions weren't trading ETFs. We couldn't trust the platforms. There was a lot of fake volume. Spreads were very wide. All that's been cleaned up, which is why we got a spot Bitcoin ETF. So even though it's not perfect, even though there are miles to go, and I'd love to see that regulation, we have made steady progress over the years, and I think we'll continue to make progress in the future.
The safety issue, the volatility connected to the safety issue, the stories about what happened to brokers like FTX in the past, those are still ringing in investors' ears. Those are especially that have a distrust of cryptocurrency. What makes the ETF wrapper here a safer place to be? Just because it's held by these institutions that have been around a long time, or they're coming from issuers like you that have good reputations? Why should retail investors feel more comfortable here?
It's a great question. You have a phenomenal stack of service providers that are helping secure these ETFs. So you have the issuers who have their reputation in the market as institutional managers. You have regulated third-party custodians, regulated estate trust chartered entities. In the case of BITB, we have the Bank of New York Mellon as the administrator of the ETF. KPMG is auditing the ETF. You as an individual can see our Bitcoin holdings online, as we discussed, and you have the full protection of the federal securities laws. If you think about that layer cake of protections, that's never been true. FTX wasn't being audited by KPMG, right? FTX was an offshore entity. We've built this incredible stack of protections that I think can give people a lot of comfort that Bitcoin has matured. It's not your father's Bitcoin. It's changed over the last 10 or 15 years. It's really in a different place.
Yeah. My father doesn't collect Bitcoin. He collects old coins. He's going backwards and he loves the old coins. What's the next big catalyst for Bitcoin? We talked a little bit about that at the top here. Is it the halving that's coming up here where it's just going to get harder to mine? What's next on the horizon? I know you study the space super closely.
Absolutely. There are probably three things on my mind. The first is the opening up of these new parts to the ETF, right? The opening up of Wells and Merrill and Morgan. I think it's hard to overstate that. Again, that's trillions and trillions of dollars. And I think that's going to happen in the next few months. In April, there's the halving where the amount of new supply being produced falls in half. It's already very little. These ETFs are buying 5,000-10,000 Bitcoin a day. We're only producing 900. But in April, we'll produce 450. So supply is going to get even tighter. And then I do think we're going to see continued success in Washington with crypto moving forward, which doesn't help Bitcoin directly. I think we may see a stablecoin bill. I think we'll see some progress in other areas. That improving regulatory conditions will also support this ecosystem. Add in potential rate cuts. It's just a very good setup for Bitcoin right now.
We used to talk about Bitcoin's correlation or lack of correlation to capital markets. We got stocks at all-time highs here. We got the NASDAQ finally at an all-time high here. Not crazy that Bitcoin is nearing its all-time high, but you're seeing that sort of contagion across cryptocurrencies. You're seeing it back in NFTs. I know you know this space very well. How much of that do you feel is the enthusiasm and how much do you feel is the froth, the hypermania that's driving things outside of Bitcoin per se higher and higher these days?
Yeah, you know, look, there's a wealth effect in every economy. People build up wealth in Bitcoin, the largest asset. And as that wealth matures, they look for riskier assets as they become wealthier. We see that in stocks. People build up in blue chips. And as the market matures, they move into small caps and they move into emerging markets. It's a natural cascade. You're starting to see that in the crypto ecosystem now. You're seeing altcoins rally, as we discussed. You're seeing some activity in NFTs. But there is a secular bull market trend going on here, which is that Bitcoin, blockchain, Ethereum, these are major disruptive innovations. The technology is improving, the regulation is improving, the security is improving. So there is a rising tide that's influencing this as well. So part is this wealth effect coming down and part is this rising tide. And I think there's years to run on this.
Like a lot of things that come on the scene, they take a little while to get the rules, right? You got the automobile. We didn't have highway rules. We didn't have traffic rules. We didn't have lights. And when that got straightened out, look what happened to that industry. All right. Curious question, though, that I was wondering, why are there different prices in different countries for Bitcoin? Is it all about the exchange rate? What's the purpose behind that?
It's mostly about the exchange rate. So in countries without capital controls, you should see the price of Bitcoin trade at the same level in every country because you could arbitrage it. If you could buy it more cheaply in the UK, it's easy to move Bitcoin to the US from London. And so those prices are remarkably tight. You do see some dislocations in countries where there are capital controls, where it's not immediately easy to translate Bitcoin to US dollars and remove US dollars. So the classic example of this is South Korea. There's long been discounts or premiums in Bitcoin to South Korea because it's a semi-closed market. And that's true of other markets as well. So in a free-flowing capital society, you'll see prices locked in. But we don't have that world, right? There are some local disruptions to the free flow of capital, and that's how you see these differential prices.
And where there's disruptions, you know there are arbitrage traders in there making hay all day long. All right, Matt, you know we're a website built on our investing and finance terms. I know you got a favorite term, whether it's a crypto term or an investing term. You've been in this game for a bit. I'd love to know Matt Hogan's favorite term.
I got to go with a crypto term. I'm going to go with a classic, which is HODL, which the reason I love it is it gets pilloried by traditional investors who sort of joke about, you know, hold on for dear life. Look at these ridiculous crypto people hodling in the corner. But of course, HODL translated into traditional finance is just buy and hold, which is the most august pinstripe suit, top hat investment philosophy you could have. Just because you put something in a new wrapper, it doesn't change what it means. I'm with the hodlers. They've been right for 15 years. I think they'll be right for 15 more. And that's my term of the day today.
We love that term, and it is back in style, to say the least. It's Matt Hogan, the Chief Investment Officer for Bitwise, out with their ETF, BITB, the Spot Bitcoin ETF. Folks, we'll link to those resources and all the good stuff coming out of Bitwise in the show notes. Thanks so much for joining the Express.
Thanks for having me. This has been great.
It's terminology time. Time for us to get smart with the investing and finance term we need to know this week. And in honor of the parade of all-time highs we're experiencing these days, this week's term is melt up. According to the greatest investing education website in the solar system, a melt up is a sudden persistent rise in the price of a security or market, often due to investor herding. Melt ups are not necessarily indicative of a fundamental shift and may reflect market psychology instead. Well, we've seen this before, like in 2021, although the Fed did floor interest rates and the government poured $7 trillion of helicopter money into the economy. We also saw it in 2010 coming out of the financial crisis, 2001, and 1932. Melt-ups usually don't end well, which is why, as long-term investors, we never want to get too far ahead of ourselves and our expectations for returns. Thanks for joining us this week, as always, and special thanks to Matt Hogan from Bitwise for climbing aboard the Express. Matt and Bitwise are right in the middle of the action around crypto ETFs, so if you're curious about that space, follow Matt's research. We'll link to that and all the reports we cited on this week's episode in the show notes, and find those wherever you ride the Express. And we'll talk again a little further on down the line.